So this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be with Guy Edmonds in Plymouth, England. Maybe Guy, you could present yourself quickly.
Hello, hi. I'm over here in Plymouth, over the other side of the Atlantic. My name's Guy, and I'm one of the students in the Cognovo program, the PhD program here, which has been running for about a year and a half. So about halfway through, and we're all looking at different aspects of creativity and cognition. Now, my background is actually in film restoration and film history. So I'm basically a humanities scholar who's washed up in this very exciting disciplinary community.
Okay, so one of the things we'd like to talk about is that your thesis is on the very, very early days of cinema, the first 10 years or so, and in particular, before cinema had actually become cinema. But can you just tell us a couple of words about that?
That's right, yeah. So cinema, as we think of it today, of course, is a kind of a dark room, or many of them, perhaps. It's a built environment. And in the first 10 years or so, cinemas as such didn't exist. You have in the States, you've got kinetoscope parlors, which uses a very different type of technology, doesn't have the projection, which is characteristic of cinema. It's kind of an individual a visual experience. And then for projection of moving images, you've got various traveling showmen going around the country and setting up temporary kind of cinemas in tents to theatrical framing by show people, actors and actresses.
Well, I guess one of the things that's interesting is that obviously in the early days, nobody knew what the history was going to turn out to be. And as we were chatting before, we were talking about how today we're sort of in the first 10 years of the cell phone as a cinematic device.
Mm-hmm.
I guess similarly, at this point, we don't know how a century from now it will have been integrated as an art form. Any thoughts?
That's right. Yeah, we can't imagine I guess I'm not too much of a futurologist. I like sifting through the evidence of the past. Of course, one reason to do that is to kind of come up with projections. I'm dealing with the physical remains of the practice of early cinema. That's kind of pieces of cast iron and brass cogs, hand ground glass lenses, lighting systems that are quite varied, actually, the types of lighting available at that time, but also very different to what is available today with kind of quartz halogen and metal halide lighting. One of my colleagues here, it's already obsolete apparently, a cell phone that has a projector in it.
Can I just interrupt you there?
Mm-hmm.
We live here with from about 3 miles from a company called Texas Instruments.
Right, they're totally a key player in the...
Well, and they would be devastated to hear from you that the technology of using cell phones as projectors is dead already, because the Pico projector is something they're still very much trying to develop a market for.
Yeah, maybe obsolete is slightly over-egging the pudding, but basically he has gone from using that phone to using a kind of more... normal, let's say, smartphone. So in a way, the technology is there. It's been made, but if people aren't using it or finding the circumstances in which it helps their life, then it becomes obsolete.
Yeah, one of the things that also is striking, and it's obviously the case now, is how, for just the history of the technology has tended to put in different streams, enough sometimes different people, the technology of images and the technology of sound. And the result is that, in fact, there have always been attempts to bridge that divorce.
That's right, yeah. It's kind of this separation of the senses, which has been necessary. The innovators who've looked at different ways of recording sensory inputs have done so by approaching the problem in a, like, let's separate this information out. So, you know, you've got Edison with the phonograph, a decade or two before the innovators of the moving image arrived at their 1895 beginnings of cinema as a paying public spectacle.
In fact, you used to work in a museum in Holland. Why don't you tell us about that and the name change that it went through whilst you were there?
Right, yeah. So I joined the Netherlands Film Museum, so basically the National Archive of Cinematographic Heritage in Holland. I joined them in 2007. And they had a major international reputation, a member of FIAF, so that's the International Federation of Film Archives in the World, and they're a custodian of a very important collection of early cinema, the films themselves. They were going through a period of transition. They're moving from a delightful turn-of-the-century building, which was kind of a seat of cinephilia, but with characteristically small audiences, to a kind of state-of-the-art, destination Starkitect building in a newly developing area of Amsterdam. And that kind of massive organizational transition they were going through was also reflected in the name change, which deaccessioned Netherlands Film Museum and came up with I. Now that was a controversial choice. There was a kind of wordplay involved in that, which I won't go into, but the river outside the building is also called the I in Dutch, but they chose the English word I, E-Y-E, to name this new institution. And of course, people immediately said, but what about the ear? The cinema has always had sound, even if it wasn't synchronized sound that appeared in the late 20s. So it's always been a kind of multi-sensory experience. And talking about early cinema again, especially in those days of the circus, you can imagine the kind of assault on the senses that was not solely limited to a kind of flickery image projected on a tent. It was the live theater of the peripheral display as well. So sound, of course, is essential to the audiovisual experience.
Let me just interrupt you there, because we're recording this today, the day before Audiovisual Heritage Day tomorrow.
Yeah, go ahead.
And indeed, ironically, it's Audiovisual Heritage Month, not Video or Oral Heritage Month Day. And so clearly in that industry, the audio and the visual are at the same level.
That's right, yeah. And that's, just to explain a bit further, it's been going for 10 years. It's a designation that UNESCO came up with as a way of promoting the work of the audiovisual archives of the world. It's basically an opportunity for the archives such as I, but also you know, much more local and regional practitioners to kind of make a bit of a song and dance of what they have in their collections and how it's important for the communities that they serve.
And it's given us the excuse to record this podcast. We've got about 3 minutes left. As our listeners may know, you're a research fellow in this Cognovo program at the University of Plymouth. There are 26 or 7 of you doing PhDs at the same time.
Yeah, 25. But
And I guess one of my questions to you was, how have you been interacting with the other PhD students, and how has that interaction affected, if at all, your thinking on your own PhD subject on the early days of cinema?
Yeah, well, the interaction is really daily. It's really a remarkable sensation. I mean, this might sound slightly banal, but it's really it's a little bit like going back to school. But because the number is 25 students. It's like a full class. The remarkable thing is that you get on with everybody. And so that's kind of a privilege that I only realized the other day. And it's like you get the chance to relive those school days and not have...
That's an interesting comment. Obviously, it is indeed a non-competitive situation, since each one of you is working on your own PhD topic. And at the same time, you know, given that you're all sharing what you're doing and keeping abreast, clearly you're also being bathed in a lot of the contemporary discussion on the connections between the different disciplines.
Exactly, and that's absolutely essential for me. As we've outlined, I come from the industry, a practicing role in a film archive. I've studied at universities, of course, to postgraduate level. But I haven't previously done something which calls for really vigorous interdisciplinary engagement. And the context that we have here is absolutely fundamental to the success of my project, because I'm having to learn about a lot of things that I didn't know much about before.
Okay, very big guy. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we look forward to continuing this conversation. I'll be coming back to Plymouth, of course. Any closing thought? You've got 30 seconds.
I guess I'm not used to kind of...
How about Viva Audiovisual Heritage Day?
That would be great, yeah. Viva Audiovisual Heritage Day.
Okay, very good. Thank you.